silence for a time. Finally, Egwene said to no one in particular, "I was only trying to make things better." "Better," Varen muttered. "You must learn there is a time to speak all of the truth and a time to govern your tongue. The least of the lessons you must learn, but important, if you mean to live long enough to wear the shawl of a full sister. Did it never occur to you that word of Falma might have come ahead of us?" "Why should it have occurred to her?" Nynaeve asked. "No one we've met before this had heard more than rumors, if that, and we have outrun even rumor in the last month." "And all word has to come along the same roads we used?" Varen replied. "We have moved slowly. Rumor takes wing along 100 paths. Always plan for the worst, child. That way all your surprises will be pleasant ones." "What did he mean about my mother?" Elaine said suddenly. "He must have been lying. She would never turn against Tar Valon." "The queens of Andor have always been friends to Tar Valon, but all things change." Varen's face was calm again, yet there was a tightness in her voice. She turned in her saddle to look over them, the three young women, Hurin, Matt, in the litter. "The world is strange, and all things change." They capped the ridge. A village was in sight ahead of them now, yellow tile roofs clustered around the great bridge that led to Tar Valon. "Now you must truly be on your guard," Varen told them. "Now the real danger begins." Chapter 11. Tar Valon. The small village of Dairion had lain beside the river Arranon almost as long as Tar Valon had occupied its island. Dairion's small red and brown brick houses and shops, its stone-paved streets, gave a feel of permanence, but the village had been burned in the Trolloc Wars, sacked when Artur Hawkwing's armies besieged Tar Valon, looted more than once during the War of the Hundred Years, and put to the torch again in the Aiel War, not quite 20 years before. An unquiet history for a little village, but Dairion's place at the foot of one of the bridges leading out to Tar Valon ensured it would always be rebuilt, however many times it was destroyed, so long as Tar Valon stood, at least. At first it seemed to Egwene that Dairion was expecting war again. A square of pikemen marched along the streets, ranks and files bristling like a carding comb, followed by bowmen in flat, rimmed helmets, with filled quivers riding at their hips and bows slanted across their chests. A squadron of armored horsemen, faces hidden behind the steel bars of their helmets, gave way to Varen and her party at a wave of their officers' gauntleted hand. All wore the white flame of Tar Valon, like a snowy teardrop on their breasts. Yet townspeople went about their business with apparent unconcern, the market throng dividing around the soldiers as if marching men were obstructions they were long used to. A few men and women carrying trays of fruit kept pace with the soldiers, trying to interest them in wrinkled apples and pears pulled from winter cellars. But aside from those few, shopkeepers and hawkers alike paid the soldiers no mind. Varen seemingly ignored them, too, as she led Egwene and the others through the village to the great bridge, arching over half a mile or more of water like lace woven from stone. At the foot of the bridge more soldiers stood guard, a dozen pikemen and half that many archers, checking everyone who wanted to cross. Their officer, a balding man with his helmet hanging on his sword hilt, looked harassed by the waiting line of people afoot and on horseback, people with carts drawn by oxen or horses or the owner. The line was only 100 paces long, but every time one was let onto the bridge, another joined the far end. Just the same, the balding man seemed to be taking his time about making sure each one had a right to enter Tar Valon before he let them go. He opened his mouth angrily when Varen led her party to the head of the line, then caught a good look at her face and hurriedly stuffed his helmet onto his head. No one who really knew them needed a great serpent ring to identify Aes Sedai. "Good morrow to you, Aes Sedai," he said, bowing with a hand to his heart. "Good morrow. Go right across, if it please you." Varen reined in beside him. A murmur rose from the waiting line, but no one voiced a complaint aloud.
"Trouble from the White Cloaks, guardsmen?"
"Why are we stopping?" Egwene wondered urgently. "Has she forgotten about Matt?"
"Not really, Aes Sedai," the officer said. "No fighting.
They tried to move into Eldone Market, the other side of the river, but we showed them better. The Armorlin means to make sure they don't try again.
Varin Sedai, Egwene began carefully. Matt.
In a moment, child, the Aes Sedai said, sounding only halfway absent-minded. I have not forgotten him. Her attention went right back to the officer. And the outlying villages? The man shrugged uncomfortably.
We can't keep the White Cloaks out, Aes Sedai, but they move off when our patrols ride in. They seem to be trying to goad us.
Varin nodded and would have ridden on, but the officer spoke again. Pardon, Aes Sedai, but you've obviously come from a distance. Have you any news? Fresh rumors come upriver with every trading vessel. They say there's a new false dragon out west somewhere. Why, they even say he has Arthur Hawkwing's armies back from the dead following him, and that he killed a lot of White Cloaks and destroyed a city. Falma, they call it. In Tarabon, some say.
They say Aes Sedai helped him,
a man's voice shouted from the waiting line. Hurin breathed deeply and shifted himself as if he expected violence. Egwene looked round, but there was no sign of whoever had shouted. Everyone appeared to be concerned only with waiting, patiently or impatiently, for his turn to cross. Things had changed, and not for the better. When she had left Tarvalen, any man who spoke against Aes Sedai would have been lucky to escape with a punch in the nose from whoever overheard. Red in the face, the officer was glaring down the line.
Rumors are seldom true, Varin told him. I can tell you that Falma still stands. It isn't even in Tarabon, guardsman. Listen less to rumor and more to the Armorlin seat. The light shine on you.
The bridge struck Egwene with wonder, as the bridges of Tarvalen always did. The openwork walls looked intricate enough to tax the best craftswoman at her lace frame. It hardly seemed that such could have been done with stone, or that it could stand even its own weight. The river rolled strong and steady 50 paces or more below, and for all that half mile the bridge flowed unsupported from river bank to island. Even more wondrous in its own way was the feeling that the bridge was taking her home. More wondrous and shocking. Emmons Field is my home. But it was in Tarvalen that she would learn what she must to keep her alive, to keep her free. It was in Tarvalen that she would learn, must learn, why her dreams disturbed her so, and why they sometimes seemed to have meanings she could not puzzle out. Tarvalen was where her life was tied now. If she ever returned to Emmons Field, the if hurt, but she had to be honest. If she returned, it would be to visit, to see her parents. She had already gone beyond being an innkeeper's daughter. Those bonds would not hold her again, either, not because she hated them, but because she had outgrown them. The bridge was only the beginning. It arched straight to the walls that surrounded the island, high walls of gleaming white silver-streaked stone, whose tops looked down on the bridge's height. At intervals, guard towers interrupted the walls, of the same white stone, their massive footings washed by the river. But above the walls and beyond rose the true towers of Tarvalen, the towers of Story, pointed spires and flutes and spirals, some connected by airy bridges a good 100 paces or more above the ground, and still only the beginning. There were no guards on the bronze-clad gates, and they stood wide enough for 20 abreast to ride through, opening onto one of the broad avenues that crisscrossed the island. Spring might barely have come, but the air already smelled of flowers and perfumes and spices. The city took Egwene's breath as if she had never seen it before. Every square and street crossing had its fountain, or its monument or statue, some atop great columns as high as towers, but it was the city itself that dazzled the eye. What was plain in form might have so many ornaments and carvings that it seemed an ornament itself, or lacking decoration, used its form alone for grandeur. Great buildings and small, in stone of every color, looking like shells or waves or wind-sculpted cliffs, flowing and fanciful, captured from nature or the flights of men's minds. The dwellings, the inns, the very stables, even the most insignificant buildings in Tarvalen had been made for beauty. Ogier stonemasons had built most of the city in the long years after the breaking of the world, and they maintained it had been their finest work. Men and women of every nation thronged the streets. They were dark of skin and pale and everything in between, their garments in bright colors and patterns or drab, but decked with fringes and braids and shining buttons, or stark and severe, showing more skin than Egwene thought proper, or revealing nothing but eyes and fingertips. Sedan chairs and litters wove through the crowds, the trotting bearers crying, "Give way!" Closed carriages inched along, liveried coachmen shouting, "Hey-ya!" and "Ho!" as if they believed they might achieve more than a walk. Street musicians played flute or harp or pipes, sometimes accompanying a juggler or an acrobat, always with a cap set out for coins. Wandering hawkers cried their wares, and shopkeepers standing in front of their shops shouted the excellence of their goods. A hum filled the city like the song of a thing alive. Verin had pulled her cowl back up, hiding her face. No one seemed to be paying them any mind in these crowds, Egwene thought. Not even Matt in his horse litter drew a second glance, though some folk did edge away from it as they hurried past. People sometimes brought their sick to the White Tower for healing, and whatever he had might be catching. Egwene rode up beside Verin and leaned close. "Do you really expect trouble now? We are in the city. We are almost there." The White Tower stood in plain sight now, the great building gleaming broad and tall above the rooftops. "I always expect trouble," Verin replied placidly. "And so should you, in the tower most of all. You must all of you be more careful than ever now. Your tricks," her mouth tightened for an instant before serenity returned, "frightened away the White Cloaks, but inside the tower they may well bring you death or stilling." "I would not do that in the tower," Egwene protested. "None of us would." Nynaeve and Elaine had joined them, leaving Huron to mind the litter horses. They nodded, Elaine fervently, and Nynaeve, it seemed to Egwene, as if she had reservations. "You should not do it ever again, child. You must not. Ever." Verin eyed them sideways round the edge of her cowl and shook her head. "And I truly hope you have learned the folly of speaking when you should be silent." Elaine's face went crimson, and Egwene's cheeks grew hot. "Once we enter the tower grounds, hold your tongues and accept whatever happens. Whatever happens. You know nothing of what awaits us in the tower, and if you did, you would not know how to handle it, so be silent." "I will do as you say, Verin Sedai," Egwene said, and Elaine echoed her. Nynaeve sniffed. The Aes Sedai stared at her, and she nodded reluctantly. The street opened into a vast square centered in the city, and in the middle of the square stood the White Tower, shining in the sun, rising until it seemed to touch the sky from a palace of domes and delicate spires and other shapes surrounded by the tower grounds. There were surprisingly few people in the square. No one intruded on the tower unless he had business there, Egwene reminded herself uneasily. Huron led the horse litter forward as they entered the square. "Verin Sedai, I must leave you now." He eyed the tower once, then managed not to look at it again, though it was hard to look at anything else. Huron came from a land where Aes Sedai were respected, but it was one thing to respect them, and quite another to be surrounded by them. "You have been a great help on our journey, Huron," Verin told him, "and a long journey it has been. There will be a place in the tower for you to rest before you travel on." Huron shook his head emphatically. "I cannot waste a day, Verin Sedai. Not another hour. I must return to Shinar to tell King Izar and Lord Agelmar the truth of what happened at Falma. I must tell them about—" He cut off abruptly and looked around. There was no one close enough to overhear, but he still lowered his voice and said only, "About Rand. That the dragon is reborn. There must be trading ships heading upriver, and I mean to be on the next to sail."
"Go in the light, then, Huron of Shinar," Verin said.
"The light illumine all of you," he replied, gathering his reins. Yet he hesitated a moment, then added, "If you need me, ever,
Send word to Faldara, and I'll find a way to come.
Clearing his throat as if embarrassed, he turned his horse and trotted away, heading beyond the tower. All too soon, he was lost to sight. Nynaeve gave an exasperated shake of her head. Men, they always say to send for them if you need them, but when you do need one, you need him right then.
No man can help where we are going now, Varen said dryly. Remember, be silent.
Egwene felt a sense of loss with Hurin's going. He would barely talk to any of them except Matt, and Varen was right. He was only a man, and helpless as a babe when it came to facing whatever might await them in the tower. Yet his leaving made their number one less, and she could never help thinking that a man with a sword was useful to have around. And he had been a link to Rand and Perrin.
I have my own troubles to worry about.
Rand and Perrin would have to make do with Moiraine to look after them.
And Min will certainly look after Rand, she thought with a flash of jealousy that she tried to suppress. She almost succeeded.
With a sigh, she took up the lead of the horse litter. Matt lay bundled to his chin. His breathing was a dry rasp.
Soon, she thought. You'll be healed soon now, and we'll find out what's waiting for us.
She wished Varen would stop trying to frighten them. She wished she did not think Varen had reason to frighten them. Varen took them around the tower grounds to a small side gate that stood open with two guards. Pausing, the Aes Sedai pushed back her cowl and leaned from her saddle to speak softly to one of the men. He gave a start and a surprised look at Egwene and the others. With a quick, "As you command, Aes Sedai," he took off into the grounds at a run. Varen was already riding through the gates as he spoke. She rode as if there were no hurry. Egwene followed with the litter, exchanging glances with Nynaeve and Elaine, wondering what Varen had told the man. A gray stone guardhouse stood just inside the gate, shaped like a six-pointed star lying on its side. A small knot of guards lounged in the doorway. They left off talking and bowed as Varen rode past. This part of the tower grounds could have been some lord's park, with trees and pruned shrubs and wide graveled paths. Other buildings were visible through the trees, and the tower itself loomed over everything. The path led them to a stable yard among the trees, where grooms in leather vests came running to take their horses. At the Aes Sedai's direction, some of the grooms unfastened the litter and set it gently off to one side. As the horses were led away into the stable, Varen took the leather sack from Matt's feet and tucked it carelessly under one arm. Nynaeve paused in knuckling her back and frowned at the Aes Sedai.
You said he has hours, perhaps. Are you just going to...
Varen held up a hand, but whether it was the gesture that stopped Nynaeve or the crunch of feet approaching on gravel, Egwene could not say. In a moment, Shiriam Sedai appeared, followed by three of the accepted, their white dresses ringed at the hem with the colors of all seven Ajahs from blue to red, and two husky men in rough laborers' coats. The mistress of novices was a slightly plump woman, with the high cheekbones that were common in Saldaea. Flame-red hair and clear, tilted green eyes made her smooth Aes Sedai features striking. She eyed Egwene and the others calmly, but her mouth was tight.
So you have brought back our three runaways, Varen. With everything that happened, I could almost wish you had not.
We did not, Egwene began, but Varen cut her off with a sharp,
Be silent!
Varen stared at her, at each of the three of them, as if the intensity of her look could hold their mouths shut. Egwene was sure that for her part it could. She had never seen Varen angry before. Nynaeve crossed her arms beneath her breasts and muttered under her breath, but she said nothing. The three accepted behind Shiriam kept their silence, of course, but Egwene thought she could see their ears grow from listening. When she was certain Egwene and the others would remain still, Varen turned back to Shiriam.
The boy must be taken somewhere away from everyone. He is ill, dangerously so, dangerous to others as well as to himself.
I was told you had a litter to be carried.
Shiriam motioned the two men to the litter, spoke a quiet word to one, and as quickly as that, Matt was whisked away. Egwene opened her mouth to say he needed help now, but at Varen's stare, quick and furious, she closed it again. Nynaeve was tugging her braid nearly hard enough to pull it out of her head.
"I suppose," Varen said, "that the whole tower knows we have returned by now?"
"Those who do not know," Shiriam told her, "will know before much longer. Comings and goings have become the first topic of conversation and gossip, even before Falma and far ahead of the war in Cairhien. Did you think to keep it secret?"
Varen gathered the leather sack in both arms. "I must see the Ammerlin immediately."
"And what of these three?"
Varen considered Egwene and her friends, frowning. "They must be closely held until the Ammerlin wishes to see them, if she does wish to. Closely held, mind. Their own rooms will do, I think. No need for cells. Not a word to anyone."
Varen was still speaking to Shiriam, but Egwene knew the last had been meant as a reminder to her and the others. Nynaeve's brows were drawn down, and she jerked at her braid as if she wanted to hit something. Elaine's blue eyes were open wide, and her face was even paler than usual. Egwene was not sure which feelings she shared, anger or fear or worry. Some of all three, she thought. With a last searching glance at her three traveling companions, Varen hurried off, clutching the sack to her chest, cloak flapping behind her. Shiriam put her fists on her hips and studied Egwene and the other two. For a moment, Egwene felt a lessening of tension. The mistress of novices always kept a steady temper and a sympathetic sense of humor, even when she was giving you extra chores for breaking the rules. But Shiriam's voice was grim when she spoke. "Not a word," Varen Sedai said, "and not a word shall it be. If one of you speaks, except to answer an Aes Sedai, of course, I'll make you wish you had nothing but a switching and a few hours scrubbing floors to worry about. Do you understand me?"
"Yes, Aes Sedai," Egwene said, and heard the other two say the same, although Nynaeve pronounced the words like a challenge.
Shiriam made a disgusted sound in her throat, almost a growl. "Fewer girls now come to the tower to be trained than once did, but they still come. Most leave, never having learned to sense the true source, much less touch it. A few learn enough not to harm themselves before they go. A bare handful can aspire to be raised to the accepted, and fewer still to wear the shawl. It is a hard life, a hard discipline. Yet every novice fights to hold on, to attain the ring and the shawl. Even when they are so afraid they cry themselves to sleep every night, they struggle to hold on. And you three, who have more ability born in you than I ever hope to see in my lifetime, left the tower without permission, ran away not even half-trained, like irresponsible children, stayed away for months. And now you ride back in as if nothing has happened, as if you can take up your training again on the morrow." She let out a long breath as if she might explode otherwise. "Faerlane!" The three accepted jumped as if they had been caught eavesdropping, and one, a dark, curly-haired woman, stepped forward. They were all young women, but still older than Nynaeve. Nynaeve's rapid acceptance had been extraordinary. In the normal course of things, it took years as a novice to earn the great serpent rings they wore, and it would take years more before they could hope to be raised to full Aes Sedai. "Take them to their rooms," Shiriam commanded, "and keep them there. They may have bread, cold broth, and water until the Ammerlin seat says otherwise. And if one of them speaks even a word, you may take her to the kitchens and set her to scrubbing pots." She whirled and stalked away, even her back expressing anger. Faerlane eyed Egwene and the others with almost a hopeful air, especially Nynaeve, who wore a glower like a mask. Faerlane's round face held no love for those who broke the rules so extravagantly, and less for one like Nynaeve, a wilder who had earned her ring without ever being a novice, who had channeled power before she ever entered Tar Valon. When it became obvious that Nynaeve meant to keep her anger to herself, Faerlane shrugged.
"When the Ammerlin sends for you, you'll probably be stilled."
"Give over, Faerlane," another of the accepted said. The oldest of the three, she had a willowy neck and coppery skin, and a graceful way of moving.
"I will take you," she told Nynaeve. "I am called Theodrin, and I too am a wilder. I will hold you to Shiri Am Sedai's order, but I will not bait you. Come."
Nynaeve gave Egwene and Elaine a worried look, then sighed and let Theodrin lead her away. "Wilders," Faelaine muttered. On her tongue it sounded like a curse. She turned her stare to Egwene. The third accepted, a pretty, apple-cheeked young woman, stationed herself beside Elaine. Her mouth was turned up at the corners as if she liked to smile, but the stern look she gave Elaine said she would brook no nonsense now. Egwene returned Faelaine's stare with as much calm as she could manage, and, she hoped, a measure of the haughty, silent contempt that Elaine had adopted. "Red Aja," she thought, "this one will definitely choose the reds." But it was hard not to think of her own troubles. "Light, what are they going to do to us?" She meant the Aes Sedai, the tower, not these women.
"Well, come along," Faelaine snapped. "It's bad enough I have to stand guard on your door without standing here all day. Come along."
Taking a deep breath, Egwene gripped Elaine's hand and followed.
"Light, let them be healing Matt."
Chapter 12. The Ammerlin Seat. Siouan Sanche paced the length of her study, pausing now and again to glance with a blue-eyed gaze that had made rulers stammer at a carved nightwood box on a long table centered in the room. She hoped she would not have to use any of the carefully drawn documents within it. They had been prepared and sealed in secret by her own hand to cover a dozen possible eventualities. She had laid a warding on the box so that if any hand but hers opened it, the contents would flash to ash in an instant. Very likely the box itself would burst into flame. "And burn the thieving fisher bird, whoever she might be, so she never forgets it, I hope," she muttered. For the 100th time since being told that Varen had returned, she readjusted her stole on her shoulders without realizing what she was doing. It hung below her waist, broad and striped with the colors of the 7 Ajahs. The Ammerlin seat was of all Ajahs and of none, no matter from which she had been raised. The room was ornate, for it had belonged to generations of women who had worn the stole. The tall fireplace and broad, cold hearth were all carved golden marble from Kandor, and the diamond-shaped floor tiles polished redstone from the mountains of mist. The walls were panels of some pale striped wood, hard as iron, and carved in fantastic beasts and birds of unbelievable plumage, panels brought from the lands beyond the Aiel Waste by the sea folk before Arthur Hawkwing was born. Tall arched windows, open now to let in the new green smells, led onto a balcony overlooking her small private garden, where she seldom had time to walk. All that grandeur was in stark contrast to the furnishings Siouan Sanche had brought to the room. The one table and the stout chair behind it were plain, if well polished with age and beeswax, as was the only other chair in the room. That stood off to one side, close enough to be drawn up if she wished a visitor to sit. A small Tyran rug lay in front of the table, woven in simple patterns of blue and brown and gold. A single drawing, tiny fishing boats among reeds, hung above the fireplace. Half a dozen stands held open books about the floor. That was all. Even the lamps would not have been out of place in a farmer's house. Siouan Sanche had been born poor in Tyr and had worked on her father's fishing boat, one just like the boats in the drawing, in the delta called the Fingers of the Dragon, before ever she dreamed of coming to Tar Valon. Even the nearly 10 years since she had been raised to the seat had not made her comfortable with too much luxury. Her bedchamber was more simple still. 10 years with the stole, she thought. Nearly 20 since I decided to sail these dangerous waters. And if I slip now, I'll wish I were back hauling nets. She spun at a sound. Another Aes Sedai had slipped into the room, a copper-skinned woman with dark hair cut short. She caught herself in time to keep her voice steady and say only what was expected. "Yes, Lyanna?" The Keeper of the Chronicles bowed, just as deeply as she would had others been present. The tall Aes Sedai, as tall as most men, was second only to the Ammerlin in the White Tower, and though Siwan had known her since they were novices together, sometimes Lyanna's insistence on upholding the dignity of the Ammerlin's seat was enough to make Siwan want to scream.
"Varin is here, Mother, asking leave to speak with you. I have told her you are busy, but she asks not too busy to speak to her," Siwan said. Too quickly, she knew, but she did not care. "Send her in. There's no need for you to remain, Lyanna. I will speak to her alone."
A twitch of her eyebrows was the keeper's only sign of surprise. The Ammerlin seldom saw anyone, even a queen, without the keeper present. But the Ammerlin was the Ammerlin. Lyanna bowed her way out, and in moments Varin took her place, kneeling to kiss the great serpent ring on Siwan's finger. The brown sister had a good-sized leather sack under her arm.
"Thank you for seeing me, Mother," Varin said as she straightened. "I have urgent news from Falma, and more. I scarcely know where to begin."
"Begin where you will," Siwan said. "These rooms are warded in case anyone thinks to use childhood tricks of eavesdropping." Varin's eyebrows lifted in surprise, and the Ammerlin added, "Much has changed since you left. Speak."
"Most importantly, then, Randall Thor has proclaimed himself the Dragon Reborn."
Siwan felt a tightness loosen in her chest. "I hoped it was he," she said softly. "I have had reports from women who could only tell what they had heard, and rumors by the score come with every trader's boat and merchant's wagon, but I could not be sure." She took a deep breath. "Yet I think I can name the day it happened." "Did you know the two false dragons no longer trouble the world?"
"I had not heard, Mother. That is good news."
"Yes. Mazrim Time is in the hands of our sisters in Saldaia, and the poor fellow in Haddon Merk, the light have pity on his soul, was taken by the tyrants and executed on the spot. No one even seems to know what his name was. Both were taken on the same day and, according to rumor, under the same circumstances. They were in battle and winning when suddenly a great light flashed in the sky and a vision appeared, just for an instant. There are a dozen different versions of what it was, but in both cases the result was exactly the same. The false dragon's horse reared up and threw him. He was knocked unconscious, and his followers cried out that he was dead and fled the field, and he was taken. Some of my reports speak of visions in the sky at Falma. I'll wager a gold mark to a week-old Delta perch. That was the instant Randall Thor proclaimed himself."
"The true dragon has been reborn," Varin said almost to herself. "And so the pattern has no room for false dragons anymore. We have loosed the dragon reborn on the world. The light have mercy on us."
The Ammerlin shook her head irritably. "We have done what must be done. And if even the newest novice learns of it, I will be stilled before the next sunrise, if I'm not torn to pieces first. Me and Moiraine and Varin, and likely anyone thought to be a friend of ours as well." It was not easy to carry on so great a conspiracy when only three women knew of it, when even a close friend would betray them and consider it a duty well done. "Light, but I wish I could be sure they would not be right to do it." "At least he is safely in Moiraine's hands. She will guide him and do what must be done. What else have you to tell me, daughter?" For answer, Varin placed the leather sack on the table and took out a curled gold horn with silver script inlaid around its flaring bell mouth. She laid the horn on the table, then looked to the Ammerlin with quiet expectation. Siwan did not have to be close enough to read the script to know what it said. "Tiami Aven Moradin is signed Devadin. The grave is no bar to my call."
"The Horn of Valair?" she gasped. "You brought that all the way here across hundreds of leagues with the hunters looking everywhere for it? Light, woman! It was to be left with Randall Thor."
"I know, Mother," Varin said calmly. "But the hunters all expect to find the horn in some great adventure, not in a sack with four women escorting a sick youth. And it would do Rand no good."
"What do you mean? He is to fight Tarman Gaiden. The horn is to summon dead heroes from the grave to fight in the last battle. Has Moiraine once again made some new plan without consulting me?"
This is none of Moiraine's doing, Mother. We plan, but the wheel weaves the pattern as it wills. Rand was not first to sound the horn. Matrim Cawthon did that, and Matt now lies below, dying of his ties to the Shadar Logoth dagger, unless he can be healed here.
Siouan shivered. Shadar Logoth, that dead city so tainted that even Trollocs feared to enter, and with reason. By chance a dagger from that place had come into young Matt's hands, twisting and tainting him with the evil that had killed the city long ago, killing him. By chance? Or by the pattern? He is Ta'veren, too, after all. But Matt sounded the horn. Then,
so long as Matt lives, Verin went on, the horn of Valir is no more than a horn to anyone else. If he dies, of course, another can sound it and forge a new link between man and horn.
Her gaze was steady and untroubled by what she seemed to be suggesting.
Many will die before we are done, daughter.
And who else could I use to sound it again?
I'll not take the risk of trying to return it to Moiraine now. One of the Gaidin, perhaps.
Perhaps.
The pattern has yet to make his fate clear.
Yes, Mother. And the horn?
For the moment, the Ammerlin said finally, we will find some place to hide this where no one but we two know. I will consider what to do after that.
Verin nodded. As you say, Mother.
Of course, a few hours will make one decision for you.
Is that all you have for me? Siouan snapped. If it is, I have those three runaways to deal with.
There is the matter of the Shan Chan, Mother.
What of them? All my reports say they have fled back across the ocean, or to wherever they came from.
It seems so, Mother. But I fear we may have to deal with them again.
Verin pulled a small leather notebook from behind her belt and began leafing through it.
They spoke of themselves as the forerunners, or those who come before, and talked of the return and of reclaiming this land as theirs. I've taken notes on everything I heard of them, only from those who actually saw them, of course, or had dealings with them.
Verin, you are worrying about a lionfish out in the Sea of Storms, while here and now the silver pike are chewing our nets to shreds.
The brown sister continued turning pages.
An apt metaphor, Mother, the lionfish. Once I saw a large shark that a lionfish had chased into the shallows, where it died.
She tapped one page with a finger.
Yes, this is the worst. Mother, the Shan Chan use the one power in battle. They use it as a weapon.
Siouan clasped her hands tightly at her waist. The reports the pigeons had brought spoke of that, too. Most had only second-hand knowledge, but a few women wrote of seeing for themselves, the power used as a weapon. Even dry ink on paper carried an edge of hysteria when they wrote of that.
That is already causing us trouble, Verin, and will cause more as the stories spread and grow with the spreading. But I can do nothing about that. I am told these people are gone, daughter. Do you have any evidence otherwise?
Well, no, Mother, but
until you do, let us deal with getting the silver pike out of our nets before they start chewing holes in the boat, too.
With reluctance, Verin closed the notebook and tucked it back behind her belt.
As you say, Mother. If I might ask, what do you intend to do to Nynaeve and the other two girls?
The Ammerlin hesitated, considering.
Before I am done with them, they will wish they could go down to the river and sell themselves for fish bait.
It was the simple truth, but it could be taken in more than one way.
Now, seat yourself and tell me everything those three have said and done in the time they were with you. Everything.
Chapter 13. Punishments. Lying on her narrow bed, Egwene frowned up at the flickering shadows cast on the ceiling by her single lamp. She wished she could form some plan of action or reason out what to expect next. Nothing came. The shadows had more pattern than her thoughts. She could hardly even make herself worry about Matt, yet the shame she felt at that was small, crushed by the walls around her. It was a stark, windowless room, like all those in the novices' quarters, small and square and painted white, with pegs on one wall for hanging her belongings, the bed built against a second, and a tiny shelf on a third, where in other days she had kept a few books borrowed from the tower library. A washstand and a three-legged stool completed the furnishings. The floorboards were almost white from scrubbing. She had done that task on hands and knees every day she had lived there, in addition to her other chores and lessons. Novices lived simply, whether they were innkeepers' daughters or the daughter heir of Andor. She wore the plain white dress of a novice again. Even her belt and pouch were white, but she felt no joy at having rid herself of the hated gray. Her room had become too much of a prison cell. What if they mean to keep me here, in this room, like a cell? Like a collar and... She glanced at the door. The dark accepted would still be standing guard on the other side, she knew, and rolled close to the white plastered wall. Just above the mattress was a small hole, almost invisible unless you knew where to look, drilled through into the next room by novices long ago. Egwene kept her voice to a whisper.
Elaine?
There was no answer.
Elaine, are you asleep? How could I sleep?
Came Elaine's reply, a reedy whisper through the hole.
I thought we might be in some trouble, but I did not expect this. Egwene, what are they going to do to us?
Egwene had no answer, and her guesses were not of the sort she wanted to voice aloud. She did not even want to think of them.
I actually thought we might be heroes, Elaine. We brought back the Horn of Valyr safely. We discovered Leandrin as Black Aja.
Her voice skipped on that. Aes Sedai had always denied the existence of a Black Aja, an Aja that served the Dark One, and were known to become angry with anyone who even suggested it was real.
But we know it's real. We should be heroes, Elaine. Should and would build no bridges, Elaine said. Light, I used to hate it when my mother said that to me, but it's true. Verin said we mustn't speak of the Horn or Leandrin to anyone but her or the Amarlin Seat. I do not think any of this will work out the way we thought. It is not fair. We've been through so much. You've been through so much. It just is not fair. Verin says, Moiraine says. I know why people think Aes Sedai are puppet masters. I can almost feel the strings on my arms and legs. Whatever they do, it will be what they decide is good for the White Tower, not what is good or fair for us. But you still want to be Aes Sedai, don't you?
Egwene hesitated, but there was never any real question as to her answer.
Yes, she said, I still do. It is the only way we will ever be safe, but I will tell you this, I'll not let myself be stilled.
That was a new thought, voiced as soon as it came to her, but she realized she did not want to take it back. Give up touching the true source? She could sense it there even now, the glow just over her shoulder, the shining just out of sight. She resisted the desire to reach out to it.
Give up being filled with the one power, feeling more alive than I ever have before? I won't.
Not without a fight. There was a long silence from the other side of the wall.
How could you stop it? You may be as strong as any of them now, but neither one of us knows enough yet to stop even one Aes Sedai from shielding us from the source, and there are dozens of them here.
Egwene considered. Finally, she said,
I could run away. Really run away this time. They would come after us, Egwene. I'm sure they would. Once you show any ability at all, they don't let you go until you've learned enough not to kill yourself, or just die from it. I am not a simple village girl anymore. I have seen something of the world. I can keep out of Aes Sedai hands if I want to.
She was trying to convince herself as much as Elaine.
And what if I don't know enough yet? Enough about the world, enough about the power. What if just channeling can still kill me?
She refused to think of that.
So much I have to learn, yet I won't let them stop me. My mother might protect us, Elaine said, if what that white cloak said is true. I never thought I would hope something like that was the truth, but if it isn't, Mother is just as likely to send us both back in chains. Will you teach me how to live in a village?
Egwene blinked at the wall.
You will come with me, if it comes to that, I mean.
There was another long silence, then a faint whisper.
I do not want to be stilled, Egwene. I will not be. I will not be.
The door swung open, crashing against the wall, and Egwene sat up with a start. She heard the bang of a door from the other side of the wall. Faelaine stepped into Egwene's room, smiling as her eyes went to the tiny hole. Similar holes joined most of the novice rooms. Any woman who had been a novice knew of them. "Whispering with your friend, eh?" the curly-haired accepted said with surprising warmth. "Well, it grows lonely waiting by yourself. Did you have a nice chat?" Egwene opened her mouth, then closed it again hastily. She could answer Aes Sedai, Shiriam had said. No one else. She regarded the accepted with a level expression and waited. The false sympathy slid off Faelaine's face like water running off a roof. "On your feet. The Ammerlin's not to be kept waiting by the likes of you. You are lucky I did not come in time to hear you. Move!" Novices were supposed to obey the accepted almost as quickly as they obeyed Aes Sedai, but Egwene got to her feet slowly and took as much time as she dared in smoothing her dress. She gave Faelaine a small curtsy and a tiny smile. The scowl that rolled across the accepted's face made Egwene's smile grow before she remembered to rein it in. There was no point in pushing Faelaine too far. Holding herself straight, pretending her knees were not shaking, she preceded the accepted out of the room. Elaine was already waiting outside with the apple-cheeked accepted, looking fiercely determined to be brave. Somehow she managed to give the impression that the accepted was a handmaid carrying her gloves. Egwene hoped that she herself was doing half so well. The railed galleries of the novices' quarters rose tier on tier above in a hollow column and fell as many below to the novices' court. There were no other women in sight. Even if every novice in the tower had been there, though, less than a quarter of the rooms would have been filled. The four of them walked round the empty galleries and down the spiraling ramps in silence. None could bear to have the sounds of voices emphasize the emptiness. Egwene had never before been into the part of the tower where the Ammerlin had her rooms. The corridors there were wide enough for a wagon to pass down easily, and taller than they were wide. Colorful tapestries hung on the walls, tapestries in a dozen styles, of floral designs and forest scenes, of heroic deeds and intricate patterns, some so old they looked as if they might break if handled. Their shoes made loud clicks on diamond-shaped floor tiles that repeated the colors of the seven Ajahs. There were few other women in evidence, an Aes Sedai now and then sweeping majestically along with no time to notice accepted or novices, five or six accepted hurrying self-importantly about their tasks or studies, a sprinkling of serving women with trays or mops or armfuls of sheets or towels, a few novices moving on errands even more quickly than the servants. Nynaeve and her slim-necked escort, Theodrin, joined them. Neither spoke. Nynaeve wore an accepted's dress now, white with the seven colored bands at the hem, but her belt and pouch were her own. She gave Egwene and Elaine each a reassuring smile and a hug. Egwene was so relieved to see another friendly face that she returned the hug with barely a thought that Nynaeve was behaving as if she were comforting children. But as they walked on, Nynaeve gave her thick braid a sharp tug from time to time, too. Very few men came into that part of the tower, and Egwene saw only two. Warders walking side by side in conversation, one with his sword on his hip, the other with his on his back. One was short and slender, even slight, the other almost as wide as he was tall, yet both moved with a dangerous grace. The color-shifting warder cloaks made them queasy-making to watch for long, parts of them sometimes seeming to fade into the walls beyond. She saw Nynaeve looking at them and shook her head. "She has to do something about Lan, if any of us can do anything about anyone after today." The antechamber of the Ammerlin's seat's study was grand enough for any palace, though the chairs scattered about for those who might wait were plain, but Egwene had eyes only for Lyanna Sedai. The keeper wore her narrow stole of office, blue to show she had been raised from the blue Aja, and her face could have been carved from smooth brownish stone. There was no one else there. "Did they give any trouble?" The keeper's clipped way of talking gave no hint now of either anger or sympathy. "No, Aes Sedai," Theodrin and the apple-cheeked accepted said together.
This one had to be pulled by the scruff of her neck, Aes Sedai, Faelaine said, indicating Egwene. The accepted sounded indignant. She balks as if she has forgotten what the discipline of the White Tower is.
To lead, Lyanna said, is neither to push nor to pull. Go to Maris Sedai, Faelaine, and ask her to allow you to contemplate on this while raking the paths in the spring garden.
She dismissed Faelaine and the other two accepted, and they dropped deep curtsies. From the depth of hers, Faelaine shot a furious look at Egwene. The keeper paid no attention to the accepted's leaving. Instead, she studied the remaining women, tapping a forefinger against her lips, till Egwene had the feeling they had all been measured to the inch and weighed to the ounce. Nynaeve's eyes took on a dangerous sparkle, and she had a tight grip on her braid. Finally, Lyanna raised a hand toward the doors to the Armorlin's study. The great serpent bit its own tail a pace across on the dark wood of each. Enter, she said. Nynaeve stepped forward promptly and opened one of the doors. That was enough to get Egwene moving. Elaine held her hand tightly, and she gripped Elaine's just as hard. Lyanna followed them in and took a place to one side, halfway between the three of them and the table in the center of the room. The Armorlin's seat sat behind the table examining papers. She did not look up. Once Nynaeve opened her mouth, but closed it again at a sharp look from the keeper. The three of them stood in a line in front of the Armorlin's table and waited. Egwene tried not to fidget. Long minutes went by, it seemed like hours, before the Armorlin raised her head. But when those blue eyes fixed them each in turn, Egwene decided she could have waited longer. The Armorlin's gaze was like two icicles boring into her heart. The room was cool, but a trickle of sweat began to run down her back. So, the Armorlin said finally, our runaways return. We did not run away, Mother. Nynaeve was obviously straining for calm, but her voice shook with emotion. Anger, Egwene knew. That strong will was all too often accompanied by anger. Leandrin told us we were to go with her, and the loud crack of the Armorlin's hand slapping the table cut her off. Do not invoke Leandrin's name here, child, the Armorlin snapped. Lyanna watched them with a stern serenity. Mother, Lyandrin is Black Aja, Elaine burst out. That is known, child. Suspected, at least, and as good as known. Lyandrin left the tower some months ago, and 12 other women went with her. None has been seen since. Before they left, they tried to break into the storeroom where the Angreal and Sangreal are kept and did manage to enter that where the smaller Terangreal are stored. They stole a number of those, including several we do not know the use of. Nynaeve stared at the Armorlin in horror, and Elaine suddenly rubbed her arms as if she were cold. Egwene knew she was shivering, too. Many times she had imagined returning to confront Lyandrin and accuse her, to see her condemned to some punishment, except that she had never managed to imagine any punishment strong enough to suit that dull-faced Aes Sedai's crimes. She had even pictured returning to find Lyandrin already fled, in terror of her return, it was usually. But she had never imagined anything like this. If Lyandrin and the others, she had not really wanted to believe there were others, had stolen those remnants of the Age of Legends, there was no telling what they could do with them. Thank the light they did not get any Sa'angreal, she thought. The other was bad enough. Sa'angreal were like Angreal, allowing an Aes Sedai to channel more of the power than she safely could unaided, but far more powerful than Angreal, and rare. Terangreal were something different, existing in greater numbers than either Angreal or Sa'angreal, though still not common. They used the One Power rather than helping to channel it, and no one truly understood them. Many would work only for someone who could channel, needing the actual channeling of the power, while others did what they did for anyone. Where all the Angreal and Sangreal Egwene had ever heard of were small, Terangreal could seemingly be any size. Each had apparently been made for a specific purpose by those Aes Sedai of 3,000 years ago to do a certain thing, and Aes Sedai since had died trying to learn what. Died, or had the ability to channel burned out of them.
There were sisters of the Brown Aja who had made Turangrial their life's study. Some were in use, if likely not for the purposes they had been made. The stout white rod that the accepted held while taking the three oaths on being raised to Aes Sedai was a Turangrial, binding them to the oaths as surely as if they had been bred in the bone. Another Turangrial was the site of a final test before a novice was raised to the accepted. There were others, including many no one could make work at all, and many others that seemed to have no practical use. Why did they take things no one knows how to use? Egwene wondered. Or maybe the Black Aja does know. That possibility made her stomach churn. That might be as bad as Sangreal in Dark Friend hands. Theft, the Amarlin went on in tones as cold as her eyes, was the least of what they did. Three sisters died that night, as well as two warders, seven guards, and nine of the servants. Murder, done to hide their thieving and their flight. It may not be proof they were Black Aja, the words grated from her mouth, but few believe otherwise. Nor do I, in truth. When there are fish heads and blood in the water, you don't need to see the silver pike to know they are there. Then why are we being treated as criminals? Nynaeve demanded. We were tricked by a woman of the Black Aja. That should be enough to clear us of any wrongdoing. The Amarlin barked a mirthless laugh. You think so, do you, child? It may be your salvation that no one in the tower but Verin, Lyanna, and I even suspects you had anything to do with Leandrin. If that were known, much less the little demonstration you put on for the White Cloaks, no need to look so surprised. Verin told me everything. If it were known you had gone off with Leandrin, the hall might very well vote for stilling the three of you before you could take a breath. That is not fair, Nynaeve said. Lyanna stirred, but Nynaeve went on. It is not right. The Amarlin stood up. That was all, but it cut Nynaeve short. Egwene thought she was wise to keep quiet. She had always believed Nynaeve was as strong-willed as anyone could be, until she met the woman wearing the striped stole. Please keep your temper, Nynaeve. We might as well be children, babes, facing our mother, and this mother can do far worse than beat us. It seemed to her a way out was being offered in what the Amarlin had said, but she was not sure what way. Mother, forgive me for speaking, but what do you intend to do to us?
Do to you, child? I intend to punish you and Elaine for leaving the tower without permission, and Nynaeve for leaving the city without permission. First, you will each be called to Shiri Aes Sedai's study, where I've told her to switch you till you wish you had a cushion to sit on for the next week. I have already had this announced to the novices and the accepted.
Egwene blinked in surprise. Elaine gave an audible grunt, stiffened her back, and muttered something under her breath. Nynaeve was the only one who seemed to take it without shock. Punishment, whether extra labors or something else, was always between the mistress of novices and whoever was called to her. Those were usually novices, but included the accepted who stepped far enough beyond the bounds. Shiriam always keeps it between you and her, Egwene thought bleakly. She can't have told everyone, but better than being imprisoned, better than being stilled.
The announcement is part of the punishment, of course, the Amarlin went on, as if she had read Egwene's mind. I have also had it announced that you are all three assigned to the kitchens to work with the scullions until further notice. And I have let it be whispered about that further notice might just mean the rest of your natural lives. Do I hear any objections to any of this?
No, Mother, Egwene said quickly. Nynaeve would hate scrubbing pots even more than the other. It could be worse, Nynaeve. Light, it could be so much worse.
Nynaeve's nostrils had flared, but she gave her head a tight shake. And you, Elaine, the Amarlin said. The daughter heir of Andor is used to gentler treatment.
I want to be Aes Sedai, Mother, Elaine said in a firm voice.
The Amarlin fingered a paper in front of her on the table and seemed to study it for a moment. When she raised her head, her smile was not at all pleasant.
If any of you had been silly enough to answer otherwise, I had something to add to your tally that would have had you cursing your mother for ever letting your father steal that first kiss. Letting yourselves be winkled out of the tower like thoughtless children.
Even an infant would never have fallen into that trap. I will teach you to think before you act, or else I'll use you to chink cracks in the water gates."
Egwene found herself offering silent thanks. A prickle ran over her skin as the Amyrlin continued.
"Now, as to what